the three pure precepts, not knowing, thereby giving up fixed ideas about myself and the universe, I vow to cease from evil, bearing witness to the joy and suffering of the world. I vow to practice good, honoring wholeness in myself and others. I vow to save all beings. These three pure precepts are the essence of our Zen path. And they are the all-encompassing, comprehensive frame for what it means to live a Dharma life, a life of awakening. And the 10 grave precepts that follow are, in a certain way, the top 10 elaborations on what that might mean. These three pure precepts have their root with the Buddha in the Dhammapada, which is the Buddha's own kind of preci of the Dharma teachings. The three precepts appear slightly differently. They appear as cease from evil, practice good, purify the mind. And this is the way these things are practiced and recited in the Theravada tradition. In the Mahayana tradition, we don't really hold much truck with this business of purifying the mind. Instead, we turn continually toward, and we save all beings. This word that we translate here as evil, and the one we translate as good, there's a case to be made that they could be translated as skillful, as unskillful and unwholesome, and skillful and wholesome. We, in boundless way, in considering this, we've decided to use the more provocative phrasing of evil. And part of the important teaching here is that if we say, cease from all that is unwholesome, do all that is wholesome, then when truly horrible things happen, we can say, look at that evil one over there. But by reminding ourselves that evil, unwholesome, is only actions arising out of grasping, aversion, and delusive certainty. This is the source of all sufferings. This is the source of all harms, big and small. There's not a categorical difference in kind. And so by acknowledging this source in ourselves, and using and recognizing that this is the very source of evil, we allow a possibility of compassionate inclusion in the face of even greatly horrible things. And important to appreciate where the three pure precepts start. They start with a ceasing, a desisting, a stopping adding fuels onto the fires of suffering. Fuel onto the fires of grasping, aversion, and delusive certainty. And this ceasing, this desisting, is exactly what we are practicing in Zazen. each time we desist from adding fuels onto the fire of whatever story we're telling ourselves, fuel onto the fire of whatever doing or trying or striving. Each time we desist, we are ceasing from harm. We are practicing this ceasing. And we practice good. It's not enough just to cease. It is utterly important, utterly essential, indispensable that we need to start with this desisting. And then we need to come forth. We need to come forth and practice good. Do good. And it's not enough to just do good, to practice good, to act wholesomely on our own behalf. We truly need to actualize good for others. We need to save all beings. This is, and the beauty of the impossibility of that phrasing, saving all beings, to say nothing of the impossibility of ceasing from all harm and doing all good. Sometimes it's translated as practice all good dharmas. Everything that's good to do, I vow to do that. So they're all impossible. But the value and the gift of that impossibility is that rather than becoming rules or checklists of things we can accomplish or not accomplish, judge ourselves to have succeeded at or failed at, they become dispositions of heart. This is an invitation of how to hold our heart. These are the guiding principles for us to make choices as we move through the world, through our lives. And our Boundless Way elaboration of these precepts draws from actually the Zen Peacemaker orders of founded by Bernie Glassman. And this has to do with some of the positive formation that precedes them. And pay attention where the precepts start in this recitation. Not knowing, thereby giving up fixed ideas about myself and the universe, I vow to cease from evil. Not knowing, this is the place, this deep, inclusive not knowing, this standing in all humility in the face of the truly unknowable and not requiring it, not requiring the universe conform to our story of it. Giving up fixed ideas about myself and the universe. This is ceasing. And this is particularly ceasing from delusive certainties. When the founder of our Zen school, Bodhidharma, he went to visit the Emperor of China. And the Emperor says to him, "So, I've followed these teachings and I've supported the Sanghas by building all of these temples and all of these ways. How much merit have I gained?" And Bodhidharma says, "No merit whatsoever." And taken aback, the Emperor says, "Who is this one? Who is this person confronting me in this way?" And Bodhidharma says, "I don't know." This is the place where the Zen school starts. This is the place where ceasing from evil starts. Not knowing is exactly what we are practicing in Shikantaza, the Zen practice of just sitting. Shikantaza can't be captured by any activity of body or mind. Shikantaza is not about having some content of consciousness and not some other content of consciousness. It is about entrusting ourselves to this darkness that is never going to be contained as a content of consciousness. All we can do is not know it. Bearing witness to the joy and suffering of the world, I vow to practice good. This is enormously important. Bearing witness to the joy and suffering of the world, this is how I vow to practice good. The name Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, her name means the one who regards the cries of the world, the one who bears witness to the cries of the world. And bearing witness to the joys of the world, this too, bearing witness. And really important to not undervalue the power of bearing witness. It doesn't end there, necessarily. But in the face of problems that cannot be solved, places this bearing witness, things in the past which we can't fix with actions in the future, we bear witness, bearing witness to ourselves in Zazen, bearing witness to the joy and suffering of the world. This is practicing good. The positive formations of the 10 grave precepts that follow also have some top 10 suggestions for positive things you may want to carry forth into your practice of good. Being satisfied with what you have, recognizing we're not separate, honoring mutuality, listening and speaking from the heart, and so on. Honoring wholeness in myself and others, I vow to save all beings. The Zen peacemaker's phrasing of this is healing myself and others, I vow to save all beings. But we say honoring wholeness. This wholeness is the fact of the matter. But we forget it. It gets covered over. But it is always the case. And this wholeness, this oneness, this singularity of everything is part of the reason why we can, in fact, do this impossible thing of saving all beings. Acting anywhere is acting everywhere. This moment, this place, fills all of time, all of space. And continually dedicating our hearts and minds, our lives, to these three pure precepts. This is the frame for all the rest of what we do in Zen, on the cushion and off.
Even though Josh appeared to end at that point, our agreement had been that all three of us would share this talk, so I'm going to give part two. So please stay in your practice while we continue to investigate these three pure precepts. When we decided to investigate these in our Dharma talks for this session, I went back to look at a book that has been very important to me throughout the, I guess, 35 years now of Zen practice, way back in the beginning, being inspired by Robert Aitken, not knowing that ultimately he would become my Dharma ancestor when I started studying with James Ford. But this was before I met James, and he wrote a beautiful book called The Mind of Clover, which is about the precepts. Hopefully some of you or many of you have read it. And as I was opening the book, I saw on the back cover this photograph of Robert Aitken Roshi, and I realized that when he wrote the book, he was younger than I am now, much younger. And he looked young. He had dark hair. He looked upright and present in his little photograph. And then as I opened the book, another photograph fell out. And it was a photograph that had been given to me by a friend who had gone out to Hawaii to meet Robert Aitken Roshi just before he died. She had been drawn to him, even though not a Zen Buddhist, all her life of practice in another tradition. And there he was, sitting in a wheelchair, looking up with a bright smile. And I thought, actually, I didn't think anything. I just felt so moved to see that picture. A man who had dedicated his life to the Dharma. He was one of the founders of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. And he also says in his book, In the Mind of Clover, how important these preliminary phrases that Josh was elucidating for us are. He says that without them, it just becomes a list of rules. Avoid evil, practice good, save all beings, got it, what's on TV? But this teaching that precedes the words that we've refined and chosen in Boundless Way Zen from these such important sources are really the guidelines. Not knowing, bearing witness, honoring wholeness. As Josh said, this is the basis of all of our practice. Just these three instructions. Forget about evil, good, and saving all beings. That can get wrapped up in the mind in a way that might not be so skillful. Right and wrong, good and bad, even self and other. So just hearing them again and really, really taking them to heart. Not knowing, bearing witness, honoring wholeness. What was it like for you when you heard about the terrorist attacks in Paris? When you heard about, well, any mass shooting in America, maybe the San Bernardino shootings? What did you feel at that moment? That feeling of sorrow is exactly where we begin our practice of the three pure precepts. The feeling of shock, the feeling of anger, whatever your specialty is. Letting yourself fully embrace this. We chose honoring wholeness instead of healing wholeness because honoring wholeness comes first. If we get lost in trying to heal or fix, we're really lost. Our delusive certainty can rise up and get in our way. Not knowing, really, in that deep sense that Bodhidharma taught us, fully, fully not knowing, no way to know. We grab at knowing, and that's where evil arises. The people who took up those guns and bombs, they knew what was right. We disagree with them. Everyone is included in the vast suffering that we live inside of in this burning world. So part of our work here, part of our work is to see when these things arise in ourselves, the divisions, the not honoring wholeness, the not being able to bear witness, not being able to really be present with reality as it's unfolding because it hurts so much. So in that place, we bear witness to the hurting itself. This is not an easy practice. This is not a casual practice. This is the practice of fully giving ourselves to the world as it is and not hiding our head in the sand. Not knowing, bearing witness, and honoring wholeness. This is the whole description of the life of a bodhisattva. Robert Aitken apparently had a lot of trouble with ordinary human interactions. We also inherited some beautiful notes from him about the precepts, about how to teach koan practice, where he says to himself, make sure that you remember to smile encouragingly at your student when they give you the right answer. Reach out and go, yes, yes. He had to remind himself because he himself got lost in his own division of his own heart, just like the rest of us, not a perfect human being, but a perfect human being, perfectly alive, just like all of us.
So these reminders, and in a sense, I think all of Zen teaching are merely reminders. We search outside ourselves, and we think maybe the rules of Zen, or maybe the teaching of Zen, will save us. But most of us, like Robert Aitken, continue to have difficulty with simple human interaction. You may have noticed this in your life, certainly in mine. The principles are so clear. Avoid evil, practice good, work for the good of all, that even a 10-year-old could say these. And yet, here I am at 63, still trying to live this way. Like, how wonderful to have encountered these teachings, to have encountered these reminders of what we know in our heart. I love what Josh and Melissa said about this is not a set of rules. Although maybe sometimes we can use it helpfully that way. But more deeply, this is a reminder of what is true in human life, what our ancestors, our grandmothers and our grandfathers learned through their bitter tears. That some of our actions do indeed lead to harm and suffering. And that we can and we should and we might look to not cause harm. And this harm, of course, is self and other. We were talking about the dedication to everyone who has been afflicted, who has been hurt by the violence, and certainly perpetrators and victims. We take on the role of one or the other, but yet in the violence, the whole world, the whole universe is hurt. And towards ourselves, we actually get to play both roles quite clearly. The judge comes up, not good enough, not worthy, not clear enough. This pointing to the activity of stopping, the action of non-action, doing nothing. These habit patterns, this karma, has such a fierce and powerful momentum. And we come here today celebrating the great intention of the founder of our way, the Buddha, who sat down under the Bo tree and vowed to do nothing, vowed to meet his life without evading, to meet his life without strategy or technique. And the incredible gift for all of us here, here so briefly, of course sometimes it seems like the period or the sesshin will never end. We're lost in suffering, lost in something. But so briefly on this planet, in the midst of this coming and going, how do we find our way? Cease from evil. Practice good. And save all beings. Thank you. So I invite you to sit comfortably. You can come around if you're behind the fireplace. And we'll have our Dharma dialogue. This is the time we have where we raise the guidelines of silence and the custody of the eyes. And encourage us all to come forward from our own experience. So from something in this talk or around practice that is alive for you, that was touched, might be a place of agreement or disagreement, but speaking from your experience, and as you raise your hand, we'll call on you one by one. So Cindy and then Pierce.
What came up for me was that place of difficulty from what I see and feel and experience and how I've been taught to handle that in my life, whether it's with silence or being polite or whatever it is. And sometimes the only way through is to be open with myself and those intimate to me about how I really feel about something. And without going there, I can't do any good. But I still fight that process. I have to keep revisiting it.
Well, I think you speak that automatic covering over.
Yes.
Right there, and we don't even know we're doing it, right? So this awareness, this bearing witness, as we were saying, to oh, look how I turn away, and seeing that this is the only place to start in noticing, and the possibility of not being polite, right? of being honest, and such a radical and risky and wonderful. Yeah. Here's.
I won't say how grateful I am to have my attention called to those phrases with which the three pure precepts begin. I must admit that when I realized that the talks would be about the precepts, I felt a little disappointed. I wasn't getting a koan that I could knock my head against and puzzle over. But immediately, I realized that I mean, I sort of asked myself, well, where are the steps that you took? They seem to have sort of drifted off. I thought that I understood their function when I took them. They were reminders of what I had not fully realized or very rarely realized. And as such, they could be useful to me. But in a situation like recent atrocities, they weren't present. And my attitude was, don't watch the news. Don't read about this. Mm-hmm. Don't even allow it to be present in your mind. Mm-hmm. And, you know, thinking about the three phrases, not knowing. I mean, one of the painful things about these events is that people are flailing about, saying, we must do this, we must do that, this is the cause, and so forth. And I don't want to hear it. In regard to bearing witness, I mean, it seems in the way that you presented it that this is something that I possibly could do. It doesn't make any difference. Maybe, or maybe it would.
Yeah.
Or maybe it would. And the third one, honoring homeless, I mean, I see very clearly with the feeling of some remorse that in saying, I don't want to hear this, I'm certainly not honoring wholeness. So I'm very grateful for this because these phrases complement the actual pure precept of refraining from evil and give it, give me at any rate more of a possibility of actualizing them. Mm-hmm. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very well expressed, and I just want to append one thing on there. Don't imagine the precepts aren't koans.
In fact, if you are a student of koans, the precepts are the last set of koans you'll work with. After some period of time, this is one of our pieces of inheritance from Robert Aitken and John Tarrant, James Ford.
My next life.
Yeah.
I get to do that.
Well, and that's why we start with them also. You know, when you take Chukai, they're precepts right then, too. They're koans right then, too. Right? They're koan nature. There's no way to say, got it. That's maybe one of the hallmarks of koan practice. You can't say, oh, right, okay, next. It's like, endless, endless, endless. Yeah. So please do raise your hands if you have other comments.
Mike and then Alan.
This honoring wholeness. It's weird how you read something over and over, and this is the first time I really. But I remember we have a call on somewhere in our curriculum where the phrase, you know, 80% is 100%. And I really, it brought that up for me. In meeting ourselves just as we are, or I'll speak for myself, I often feel broken or limited in so many different ways. And have the lovely opportunity here to see that again and again. Often a painful experience, actually. But the sense that in looking, sort of shining the light within again and again, that wholeness is very much related. I mean, that brokenness is very much related to the state of the world. That often what I'm feeling inside myself is, I'm not even always aware of it, but some reflection of the world that we live in, and which is suffering so much, and this strange way that it's a reflection of wholeness, and you know, is like this root of caring in a way that you know, the refugees are of ourselves. I just want to thank you for that. I think that's, for me, that's what the talks were very much about, how It feels like a paradox in saying, I'm broken, and that brokenness is my wholeness. But that's what feels is true to me.
Yeah. I think we'd agree with you.
Honoring brokenness as wholeness. Mm-hmm. Yeah, wholeness as brokenness.
Josh quoted the Theravada version. The last part of it is to pure. What is it? What
purifying is the mind.
Purifying the mind, man. Doesn't it sound appealing? Mm-hmm. And of course, it's purifying the heart mind. You know, I'm totally pure, right? Mm-hmm. And we heard that. We were at a conference. Bob and Josh and I were at a conference where some Theravadan teachers and scholars were talking, and they're still into the whole purification thing. There's a book called The Path of Purification, and it's a medieval text, you know, that everybody uses. And I think it's very significant that in Zen we say the brokenness is the wholeness. That means that this life that we're living now is the whole thing. And we don't have to live in the delusive sense of the past, because that's a delusion too, whatever we happen to remember, but, you know, whatever we've done or other people have done, and the delusive sense of the future. We get to live in the delusive sense of the present. Yay! What a relief. Yeah. So thank you for pointing to that beautifully.
Yeah, I wanted to thank Josh for talking about why we retain that word evil in the version that we use of the precepts, and as a reminder that evil isn't something that we point to outside of ourselves, but evil as something that we have to start by refraining from in ourselves, so that we don't jump to that self-other move that's so tempting. You know, especially when things are happening that really do seem evil, you know, and so that we're challenged to not do that othering and that pointing. And I've been really troubled by one of the things in the current atmosphere that troubles me the most is that those people at the national leadership level who are trying to be the most thoughtful and even use terms like empathy are being derided as, you know, weak and pathetic, and I feel this awful, you know, movement towards exactly the opposite of what we're trying to practice here. And so it really is comforting for me to be with the Sangha, you know, and not feel alone. And I even wonder, this came up for me, I wonder if it's time for us to start interacting more, not just at the leadership level at national meetings, but at the membership level, you know, at all levels, with all of the other Buddhist groups in the greater Boston area, because I'm wondering if, you know, we're going to really want this bigger sense of community as the world around us, you know, goes to this really dark place.
Thank you, Alan.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Laura and Paul and Justin.
I wanted to talk a little bit about that honoring wholeness too. That phrase really grabbed me. In the sense of it made space for all of my reactions to what's happening. Like I noticed when I first heard of the San Bernardino shootings that what came up for me was first, like, you know, and then anger, lots and lots of anger. And then self-righteousness around, like, well, I know what to do to fix this, and if I was running things, you know, and all this, all these different reactions. And then what comes later is the sobbing and, you know, over the... And so this honoring wholeness... Even the reaction that Pierce talked about, you know, I don't want to hear this. It's like, it's all included.
Exactly.
It's all there. It's because I can think that I'm just supposed to have this the perfect reaction, you know, and what would that be? But it's like, I don't do that. I like get mad or I, you know, whatever it is I do. And then there's a journey with what that is. It starts one way and moves into, of course, it has no fixed position either. But, just helps me to embrace all of it for myself and honor all of it. That it's all useful. Dharma arising as anger, Dharma arising as sobbing, Dharma arising as I don't want to hear it. It's like it's all useful.
I'm really glad you called out the what something Pierce said. You know, it could be interpreted as I shouldn't want to hide from it, but the wanting to hide from it is it too.
Yeah.
You know, there's any response is the response, and then if we bear witness to that, something does happen. Just like in our sitting practice, which Josh is pointing out, this is our Dharma, this is our formal meditation practice and our informal life practice to meet everything as it. Yeah, very. I also wanted to call out something that Josh said. The reason we use evil is because it's provocative. Zen is provocative. It's not just nicey-nice. I hope you've gotten that so far. You know, it's like it's not okay to not, etc. Right? We really want people to be fully alive in our lives. So anytime we can provoke that bubble of certainty, that bubble of protection, even though it's also it can be provoked. Yeah, it's very important.
I really appreciate the collection of talks today. The pointer as far as the three tier precepts. And I think particularly the repetition of don't know, bearing witness, and honoring wholeness. And as I was listening to the various the talks, I remember the fourth point that David offered us last night. Do our best. In some cases, it's it's a frame around a frame. It's a fourth one. It's all that's there. When I hear this aspect of don't know, this aspect of bearing witness, this aspect of honoring wholeness, in doing my best at it, doing my best. That's there. Earlier this year, there was a meeting of many of us who had recently been ordained. And as we were going around, we were supposed to share what has our ordination or our priestlyhood has meant to us. And the first thing I said is that they said that I was a failure. Again, I cried. And I think what was so good was for me to hear me say those words, which I knew deep down that I was a failure. And to see the faces of all of my peers around me as they heard me say those words. And it wasn't one of, oh, Paul, you're not a failure. It's just you can see it in the eyes. And it is these three peer precepts for me. This aspect of don't know. This aspect of bearing witness. This aspect of honoring wholeness that's here. Doing my best. At 9:20, I put on my seven-piece robe, and I process and join the song, which I'm always at work. Thank you.
You know, it's moments like this that make me glad we're at Sesshin and not just an ordinary gathering of people hanging out together. This is saying something so rich and deep and important that touched at least me, but I gathered from visually a few others. And we don't have to fix it. And the guidelines that David spoke about last night help us to not rush up to you and talk to you, reassure you. And even in that meeting, nobody did that. We're trained to bear witness, right? So this is, this. It isn't, we don't stay silent, not make eye contact, stay still because it's a good idea, just like we don't avoid evil, practice good because it's a good idea. And these are not, you know, the legend that we tell is that the Buddha came up with these precepts because people kept screwing up in the Sangha. He said, I have an idea. Let's avoid evil. You know, let's not kill people. How about that? It really penetrates down deep into the reason we practice at all, which is to allow our life to unfold as it's unfolding and to give people the privacy to have that life, right? To actually not be fixed, not be commiserated with, just to sit next to and breathe together with. I'm really happy that you could say that in this holding context.
And I think so important as we listen to the Dharma talks and the Dharma dialogue to stay close to what's happening in ourselves. Everyone who speaks is you. You with the broken heart, you with the revelation, and not needing to make others. And part of what makes this so rich is that then we all speak the voice of the Dharma, and we listen to what we already know deep in our hearts. Yeah. Justin?
So thanks to everyone, because this has brought up a lot of things for me around, I think it got blossomed when Pierce was talking around, like, it just seems in the world recently there's been so many terrible, terrible things and shootings after bombings after shootings after bombings, and I think my response, which has been similar to this turning away. I don't want to deal with it. I don't want to hear about it, because I think that there's not enough that I can do. And it's nice that we've been able to talk about that. And I think that after hearing Paul talk, for me, it's easier to bear witness and be compassionate with other people when they feel like failures, but not so much when I do. And just, I guess, I felt for me the need to see that and bear witness and bear witness to myself in front of everyone here at the Sangha and just say it. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Todd, then Jessica, and Steve.
I'm really appreciating the kind of, this is connected to the last few comments and what you said, Melissa, about kind of the opportunity to sit with the question rather than seek the certainty. I was having the experience of, there was a line that somebody, one of you said about harming, these things harm the universe. And I had this experience of feeling like, well, can the universe really be harmed? It's the universe. It's the whole universe. You know, honoring wholeness, kind of what Mike was saying about the brokenness. Can the universe really be harmed? And I had this all kind of like, first this joyful welling up of like, no! And then immediately feeling like I was about to just fall off the edge into this like nihilistic nowhere. And then sitting on the edge of that knife. And then the impulse to like dull down that knife so I don't fall off the edge one way or the other. But the opportunity to just sit on that edge and go, oh, it's so difficult. I mean, I can feel how being here, you know, I let myself sit on it for 3.5 seconds instead of the 3.5 milliseconds that normally I would just pick a side, you know, or something. So yeah, sitting with that, what a great gift.
And feeling how the mind so wants to wrap it up.
Yeah.
You know, it just, the mind doesn't care one side or the other, it just wants it resolved. Right? And that, to feel that impulse, and to maybe just for a few seconds, not to go there. Just,
And I can even feel it moving. If I let it sit there in my mind for, I can even, now I can feel it in my body.
Yes.
And, you know, now my leg is twitching. Like, just, and it's like, yeah.
Yeah. And I just want to resonate with both you and David. You know, with we so want to just know, right? We want to be sure, and we can see it in our shikantaza. We can't be sure we're doing it right. So, God damn it, I'm going to be sure I'm doing it wrong.
Yes,
that resonated.
Yeah. Oh, Jess. Jess.
Oh, Jess.
Yeah. I am very grateful just for the talk and for what everyone has said, and your reminder that everyone is speaking from me too. I can agree and relate to what everyone has said. And also, I was struck by, you know, Justin talking about this ability to bear witness when and it's easier to express compassion than other people are showing their cracks or feeling the failure, and how unwilling I have been to bear witness to my own sense of feeling like a failure. Mm-hmm. And what, you know, what has been my barrier to this? And I think I've been, as I've been listening to people, I've been noticing some of the barriers of just this unwillingness to feel helpless and hopeless. Mm-hmm. And just not knowing how to make space for those things without feeling completely consumed by them.
Yeah.
And so then I find myself not wanting to bear witness to certain things that might trigger the hopelessness of
yeah, right.
Or, you know, let me, it's okay to not know about that, but I can't not know this. Oh my gosh. And, you know, noticing that there are these different sort of triggers, and finding myself kind of going right back into these habits of mine. I got to do summer sesshin, and afterwards it's like, oh, it's great. I can see everything now. I'm not going to pick up. Perfect. I'm healed. I'm cured. Everything. And how quickly the mask goes right back up, and how quickly the habits of mind, maybe even almost stronger than before. And then the judging, and oh my gosh, you're such a failure. How could you do that for a week straight, and then go home, and you can't even do it, you know, for a couple minutes. And so it's just wonderful to be back and kind of recalibrate, and to try to find a way to have some more willingness to just allow what comes up to be there. You know, this stubbornness and my mind have been so powerful to take me so far in my life that it's really hard to let go of them.
Yeah.
But they're not serving me.
Yeah.
You know, right. Or others. And so
I think it's so important to appreciate the value of what got us here. So these very stubbornness, these things are not bad. It's not like, oh, I've been bad all my life and now I'm going to be good. But I think really this looking, one, to see the limitations, if there's only one possibility, and then to see, does this serve me now? And then even when we realize it doesn't serve me now, to feel the terrible momentum and how challenging. And, you know, it's why we come back to the cushion again and again, you know, to one more time vow to cease from, or to vow to open our heart, or vow, you know, what. But it's a great vow that's required. But it's the vow of our heart that is the truest thing in our life. and we touch that and we're terrified, but we're grateful. Oh, I remember what I want. There's something I really want. It's to be here. I just forgot.
Good. Thanks. And Steve, the last one.
So this honoring wholeness, it's easy for me to fall into the delusion that there is a wonderful wholeness that I'm missing out on because of my faulty reactions, you know, and that if only I could perfect myself, then, you know, I could replace how I actually feel with something else that would be a whole lot simpler and more comfortable. But that, the unfortunate thing about that is that when really horrific things happen, it that notion completely falls apart. You know, so, you know, what does it mean for there to be some great universal beauty in the midst of a world that is in flames and smashed and broken? And if we hold up the idea that there is some wonderful wholeness that is other than what's actually here, I get so depressed about, you know, so things are broken, you know, and here I am in the middle of this brokenness, and my reactions are all wrong, and I need to fix this. So I've really been practicing trying to honor wholeness in the form of smashed and broken, shot through with agony and disbelief and horrified at what's going on. And going back to something Josh said about, you know, the only source of these evil actions is our greed, our anger, and our ignorance, and how it comes up in me in the form of those bad people, we need to show them, you know. And I think everyone believes that, don't they? You know, that there's this other group of bad people that we need to show, you know, that this is unacceptable. Any means, giant wall, dropping bombs, blowing things up, shooting people, whatever it takes, letting myself feel it. So, where does the certainty come from that makes me so sure that it's okay to hurt people in order to honor my values of honoring life?
Well said. And I also want to, something that's been bubbling up for me, and that was a wonderful introduction to it. I think that we here in America have been living in the Buddha's palace, you know, the young prince's palace, for many, many years. And things have been this bad. If you talk to somebody in any other place in the world, they've been forced to face these things a long time ago. So you have to think back 2,600 years, the Buddha, you know, when he goes out of the palace and he actually sees death, illness, old age for the first time. Every single one of us gets to see that at some point for the first time. Many people around the world see it when they're tiny little children. We've been so protected. But this is human nature. And it's one side of human nature, right, which you just described perfectly, Steve. And then the other side is actually bearing witness to that version of splitting and opposition. And this is what we're doing here. Now, 2,600 years of Buddhism and the world hasn't improved. Right? I just read an article about Buddhists at war. It's not about fixing, but somehow coming into being brave enough, being really brave enough to face these realities in our own hearts, which you just talked about.
And then to do what we can. Mm-hmm. Right? So we keep going to this place of, well, it actually is exactly as it is, and Buddha nature manifesting everywhere. And there are times when we can act with kindness, or when we can do something, not just about doing nothing. So we practice both.
Yeah. And what we do is never enough, never enough, never enough, and totally enough, and never enough.
Thank you.